Okay, great. So it's good to see everyone. Today, as I said, I have some graphics that I'd like to share with you. We'll see if that works. But before I do that, I would like to give just a little introduction about what came to my mind, what I wanted to talk about during this time. And recently, so over the last bit of time, over the last time that I've been doing some personal Bible study, I've been looking at the letters in the New Testament. So there are particularly two things that I'd like to point out, because reading through, there were some things that kept jumping out at me the whole time. There were some things that kept surprising me almost, that I was surprised were mentioned so much and so strongly in the New Testament letters. And they're quite a large chunk of the Bible and definitely a large portion of the New Testament. So the things that jumped out at me were these two words, or these two problems, let's say. Often when writing the letters are from Christian teachers or wise individuals or godly individuals to a church or to a group of Christians or something like that. And they were often addressing problems. And the two problems I saw crop up time and time again were these two: disunity or division, and suffering, pain and suffering. And I was surprised how much this kept cropping up. So I asked the kind of question to myself, why do these points keep coming up? And one could say that they come up because they were the problems people had. They came up because, in first century AD, they didn't have Zoom, they didn't have the internet. Of course, connectivity issues were a problem. They were disconnected. They're all over the world. Yeah, that's definitely a problem. You might say that. Or you might say suffering. They were in a Roman Empire known as a brutal empire. Of course, that's likely to be a problem. And those are both valid reasons, but I think the problem goes a bit deeper than that. There's a deep reason these two things keep coming up. And I think if we look back at the story of the Bible, if we try and take a very brief overview of the story of the Bible, we see a God who is a relationship. And not exactly a God that's in a relationship, but a God that is a relationship: Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Three distinct but connected persons, and maybe persons isn't even the correct word, but we see these three distinct but connected parts of the Godhead: Father, Son, Holy Spirit. And we see the creation of the world as an extension of that relationship, as a or an outflow or outpouring of that love, that the world is created because God wanted to share that love, he wanted to share that relationship. That's the story we see in the Bible. Which is maybe not often how it's told. But what we see as the story continues in the Bible, very much on the first few pages, is that humanity, who is created like God, God says, let's make man in our own image, in our own image. And we see humanity reject that. We see humanity go away from that. And then in comes this disunity, this division, this separation from God. And if you walk away from the author of life, what are you left with? You're left with death. You're not just left, if you break a relationship, if you walk away from a relationship, you're left with disunity. But you're also left with, if you walk away from that author of life and love, you're also left with suffering and pain. And that is very much the situation of the world. And of course, I'm sure we all know that the story continues, and that is not where the story ends. But that, I think, is why these particular problems, even when writing to groups of Christians, keep cropping up and keep coming up. So what I'd like to do in this time is look at one of those letters, one of the letters in the New Testament, and try and go through the advice that's given to counteract these two problems, and try and go through and give a little overview of that book. Now, some of you might already be guessing at which book I'm going to go to, which letter I might go to. I'm sure there are many good ideas. There are many ones you could turn to, many letters that could go to, because, as I said, I think this is a recurring theme. But the one I'd like to talk about is the first epistle of Peter. So I've made a little presentation, a slideshow, which I know, of course, some of you won't be able to see, but I'll say the words anyway. And most of the presentation is just Bible verses, so people can have an ease of seeing those verses. So if I share that, please let me know if you can see it. Oh.
Yes, we can.
Great. Okay, so I hope now you can see the presentation. As I say, it's not that crucial, but it might help to keep a bit of interest and attention as we go through. You can see the pictures. So why look at 1 Peter? And I think particularly the book of 1 Peter is addressing these two points. Why do I think that? Well, in the first chapter, we see even in the first verse, talking about disunity, the book itself is written to the ones, to the elect exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. I'm not actually sure where that is. I'm sure someone could tell me afterwards. But this book is actually written to a group of Christians who have been dispersed. It seems like Jewish Christians who have been dispersed, who have been separated out all over the world, already a very difficult situation. And to make it worse, they're people who want to put their trust in Jesus, who have come to know the goodness of Jesus and come to know his story and how he came to redeem the world, put their trust in him. And because of that, the people around them, who are already hating them because they're exiles and they've come to live in their home and they're immigrants and it's a difficult situation, then have heaped abuse on them. And we see in verse 6 that Peter acknowledges they've been through various trials and they've been grieved, they've had a difficult time. And he continues this to talk about the reason he's writing the book. He says, he realizes they're in this situation and says that the genuineness, the tested genuineness of your faith may result in praise, glory, and honor at the revelation of Jesus. And I've actually just going to move these verses around and put the aim first. I've underlined it there. I hope you enjoy that graphic. To show and to maybe illustrate that often when we come to the Bible, we come with some problems or we come with an issue that we want to solve. And there is answers and there is a solutions to our issues. But if we look at it the other way around, if we see the aim of these books, if we see the point of these books, the books is for us, is to help us and to show us that our role as the church and our obligation is to glorify God, that we are an extension of that relationship. Now we can cry out, Abba Father, we've been brought into this relationship with God the Father, that we are now called his children, this very privileged relationship it talks a lot about in the Bible. And we're now in that position. And it also talks about, the Bible talks about how we are ambassadors on earth, that we represent now God on earth. So if we come to the Bible, if we come to this book, realizing that that's the aim of it is to show that we are an extension and to show how we can best glorify God on earth, we then see that the way we can do that is by solving these issues that we see all around and also we see in the church, the disunity and the suffering. And I've made a list here, and I honestly never thought I'd be the one to stand and say, here's my list of 7 things. And I, no word of a lie, I was going through the book, writing down the points that I thought there were, and it just coincidentally happened to be 7. This wasn't some big conspiracy theory to make everything a number of 7s. I know that can happen sometimes. So here's the list. I'll read it out for those who can't see. And I've tried to put it in order of the book has it. First one is be holy. Second one is building or building up. That's maybe a bit of a cryptic one, but I'll try to explain as we go through. Third one, subjection to authority. And the fourth one I've put in capitals because I think it's a particularly important one at the moment, home life, since that's the way most of us are living at the moment. Number 5, being different to the world. Number 6, reacting to persecution. And number 7, to shepherd the flock. And these 7 things, Peter's writing, giving instruction, how these things will help us glorify God and particularly help us with the problem that these people were having, and I think that we all have, with disunity and divisions, particularly in the church, and pain and suffering that we also go through. So the first one, be holy, says in chapter 1, verse 15, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. And you might say to me, well, you've just told me there's 2 points about disunity and suffering. So now you're talking about being holy. It doesn't really seem connected. And maybe that's slightly true. I'm not saying that these are the only 2 points that this book does talk about. But I will say further that this, as you read on, you will see how this is connected. Holiness is an interesting concept. I think if you asked a stranger on the street what holiness was, they'd probably think of some ceremony, some religious thing, which maybe wouldn't be too far from wrong. And often the definition given is not doing anything that's wrong, not doing bad things. That's someone who's holy, a holy person. I'd like to take it a little bit further and say that at the end of this section, talking about how we should be holy, in chapter 1, verse 22, we see the outcome of it, the reason is it, of it, that we should be holy for a sincere brotherly love, that we should love one another earnestly from a pure heart. And that seems like almost a strange, but at least an extreme outcome of being holy. It seems that it's more than just not doing the wrong things. It seems like it's doing more, going above and beyond to do not just what is right, but what God is and wants us to do, and that's to be love. It's a very strong phrase, to love one another earnestly. As I was thinking about this talk, was trying to imagine what it might look like to love someone earnestly, to really love them really a lot, to try and do the best for them, to exactly imagine that. It's a bit of a strange phrase. But I think it's just desperately trying to show that it's not just loving someone, brotherly love, you know, where we have siblings probably and friends and, you know, we love them and we want the best for them. But it's to love them earnestly, to really desire the best for them over the best for us. And we see the outcome of that in the next verses. It's to put away all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, slander. There's very practical things we can do. And if we were living this way, imagine if the whole church was living this way without maliciousness, without deceiving, without any hypocrisy, without gossiping or slandering about each other, but purely loving each other more than we love ourselves. Do you not think that that would very quickly solve the issues of division and disunity? Do you not think that that would negate a lot of our suffering that we cause to each other by hurting one another, by being disrespectful or impatient or quick-mouthed or hot-tempered, things like this? Do you not think that would instantly solve so many of these issues? I mean, of course, we know it's difficult to do, but this is the advice and the dream almost that the book is putting forward. And we see another outcome is that when we do this, it's not just something hypothetical, that it will prepare our minds for action, that there is a positive, a physical outcome, that we'll be ready to act and we'll be a useful church, a church that does things that can help people. If we're not fighting each other, then we'll be prepared for action. So that's the first point. Let's move on to the second one. I've got a nice picture of a building. It's just a stone building, if anyone can't see. And the title is about building, and Peter introduces this metaphor, this concept, that we are living stones built up as a spiritual house. And it talks about how the Lord Jesus is the true cornerstone, and we should be built into that. And there are analogies and pictures of the church in the Bible. And another one that has a similar idea behind it is that of a body, that we are one unit. And this one is that we are a house. We are a stone house, and we're each an individual stone building up that house. And of course, you can realize that if you take out one stone, maybe the house is okay, but you start taking out a lot of stones, the house falls down. And of course, we need to remember that the house is built on Christ, the cornerstone. And it links in, and these verses aren't in 1 Peter, but it links in very well this idea that's all through the Bible, that we're encouraged to build one another up. We hear in 1 Peter that the house is built by God. The house is built on Christ as the cornerstone, and built by God. But we as brothers and sisters, as members of the church, can build one another up. It says, pursue the things that make for peace and building up. When we have an argument, when we have a disagreement, particularly with Christians, particularly with the church, do we pursue peace? Or do we sit back and say, oh, I'd rather this just, you know, went away. Let's just leave it. It's too difficult to resolve. Let's just leave it. And it really is a thing that I feel quite strongly about, because I think as a church, I've been to, you know, different meetings and other churches as well. And I think one thing the church is very good at is encouraging. I think a lot of times you'll go somewhere, you hear an encouraging message. You'll hear something that's encouraging and, you know, makes you feel strong and empowered. And that's great. The Bible tells us to do that. We should encourage each other that the Lord Jesus is coming back. He's going to set the world right. But one thing that I see is lacking a lot is this idea of building up or rebuking is maybe a different facet of that. It's not just say, if someone gives a message, for example, if I do, or someone else gives a message, it's just an example, but one thing you could say is you could encourage them and say, well, that was really good. Thanks for trying. You know, I'm sure God can use any words that are spoken. And that's great. People have said that to me. That's really good. We're told to encourage one another. But is something we do build up and say, well, you could have done this a bit better? You see a fault, or maybe fault's a bit of a strong word, but you see something that someone can improve. And do we really want to build up that person? Do we want to make every member of the church better? Do we want to push them to be more like Christ? And something that's difficult is criticizing. Of course, we can be overcritical. Of course, we should do it in a loving way. But criticizing and pushing people to be more like Christ and say, actually, that thing you just said to that other brother or sister, that was not said in the best way. Maybe you could do that better. And I'm sure we can all think of many examples where it's needed, actually, not really to criticize, but to build up, to say, you should be more like Christ in this. To rebuke is often a biblical phrase that's used. So I'll leave that one there and move on to the next point. And that's subjection to authority. I'll read the verse for those who can't see. It says, be subject to the Lord for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor or governors sent by him. Now, we don't have an emperor, but we have a prime minister. And we also have people who are in charge. We have governors and things like this. And it's a simple point. There's not a lot to say about it. It's a practical point. When we hear advice, especially now, we're hearing a lot of things from the government, and normally we might not be too interested what they're saying, but especially now, and when they're giving us a lot of advice, the thing we should do is be subject, respect the people that God has allowed to be in control of our nation. And in the same chapter, the same idea, which is some perhaps a little bit more applicable to us, because many of us have bosses and people we work for and people we you know, are over us in some way, says, servants, be subject to your masters with all respect. It's a very practical point. I don't want to say too much about it because we all know what it means, but I just want to encourage us to, maybe the next time we get something from our boss or from the person in charge or the governors, just to take a step back and think, how can I show this person that I'm a Christian, that I respect authority, that I care about their opinions and I love them and I want their best, and I want to put other people in front of myself? So the next one is home life. And I said this is quite a big topic. And I just, well, it wasn't me actually, Rachel just quickly Googled some stats. I'm sure we've all heard similar stats, statistics to this. This one says that 49% rise in calls to abuse helpline compared to average during lockdown. And that from a survey that happened, that tensions had risen, people said this, and that 80% admitted to arguing with the people they lived with. It's a huge number. And I'm sure we've seen similar stats. I know reading the news, I've seen plenty of similar things. And probably for us too, probably for people here, although hopefully not, but I suspect probably there has been tension. We know that there's a tension from constantly being living and being locked inside with someone, particularly at the moment. And this is a call for all of time, but particularly we see the problem now during lockdown, that our home life is difficult. And for anyone that's interested, I also added a quick list here, the top stress points causing home arguments. And it seems silly. If you can read them, I won't read them all. Money's almost obviously the first one. But number three, TV choice. You wouldn't expect what you watch on TV or what some families watch on TV to be the reason for 31% of stress and arguments in the home. Not washing up properly, maybe you can understand that one. Leaving damp towels on the floor. It seems ridiculous, but we as people so easily get drawn into arguments, so easily get drawn into problems and issues that we're one step away, it seems. We're 4 weeks of lockdown away from having a big argument about who's done the washing up poorly. And it does just go to show, I think it has revealed to me, and has probably revealed to many other people, how fickle we can be, and people we love and care and live with in the same house. And people maybe you've married, I mean, people you've chosen to spend your whole life with, you're now at odds over them leaving a towel on the floor by accident. Maybe they do it every day, maybe it's really frustrating, but we see how easily it happens. But what does the Bible say about it? What does 1 Peter say about it? Particularly, it has this advice to wives and husbands. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won by the conduct of their wives. And I've heard a few people, maybe not, but I've heard a few people have problems with this verse. It's quite a contentious verse for our times. Wives, be subject to your husbands. It's quite a difficult verse, contentious verse. But we see, actually, if we look at it in context of the whole book, what this is telling wives to do is no more than it's telling all humans or all Christians to do for all the people around you. Be subject. Put someone else's desires above your own. Be willing to do what that other person wants to do instead of doing what you want to do. Be willing to listen to someone's opinion and do it instead of your own opinion. And maybe I'm a bit hypocritical saying this as a man, saying, oh, women, you should do that. But I want us to show that this is really what we're all called to do. We saw in the previous chapter, we're called to do it for people who are in power above us. We're called to people to do it for people who are our bosses and who we work for and work with. And in fact, if we read the whole Bible, we see that we're called to love and consider others more important than ourselves, it says in Philippians 2, for the whole of humanity. And this is really an extension for that. And I'll say the same point. I believe, and I think that it makes sense that a house would run better if everyone really, but particularly this is directly at wives, if we were considering other people more important than ourselves and their desires above ours. And then the second verse is addressed to husbands, people in the home, that they are to live with their wives in an understanding way as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you. And I'm not going to make many comments. I mean, judge for yourself to be subject and consider someone more important than yourself, or to live with and try and understand someone, which is more difficult. I'm not sure. But there's a call and there's an encouragement to both sides of the relationship, especially here it's mentioning about a wife and a husband. There's a call for both sides of the relationship to be sacrificial, to put the other person in front of themselves. And we see through the Bible that that is our call as Christians, and that is an outcome of us seeing God's love to us, seeing Jesus' love to us when he, who himself is God, put himself in a low place, a humble place, again in Philippians 2, so that we could be brought and so that we could benefit. Next point, we're past halfway now of my list of points. And I hope you like this graphic. I've got a yellow duck who's standing out against a background of grey ducks. And my next point, as I was reading through 1 Peter, is that we are called to be different to the world. And I'll read the whole few verses that I've put up here. It says, "Live no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join with them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you." This is a very interesting set of verses, just three verses. And being different in the world, we see, can lead to suffering. It's almost a strange outcome that if you don't join a drinking party, they're going to see that. People might see that and heap abuse on you, malign you. It seems a strange outcome, but I think many people have seen that in the world. And I've been to university and have seen it very much firsthand, that there's a culture, especially I think in this country, drinking culture, partying culture, that if you don't join in with, you're seen as strange. I think fortunately, we as Christians don't suffer huge persecutions, that we do live at least in a society that it is not persecuting and aggressive towards Christians. But there still is, I'd say, an opposition, or still is a realization that there's something strange about us if we don't join in with this same debauchery. You would think, you would think that if someone was really your friend, or if they were really, you know, another person's friend, and you'd seen your friend damaging their body, you know, drinking is quite damaging. If you'd seen someone doing that to their body 5 nights in a row, drinking really excessively, really, you see, hurting their liver, you think the natural response of a friend would be, whoa, Pete, Sam, slow down. That's going to damage your body for a long time to come. But in actual fact, a lot of the time, the response is chug, 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 chug. There's a very strange, strange reaction to that phenomenon, which we as Christians should be different to, can be different to, and can stand out for being different in that way. And that leads me to the next point: reacting to persecution. This verse says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. We've seen from the previous few verses that when we are different, that when we choose to follow Christ, when we choose to live in a way that glorifies Christ, people will find it strange. People will find it difficult. And in the same way that they found it difficult for Christ to live that way, they'll find it difficult for us to live that way. Because we know if someone's being a goody-goody two-shoes, let's say, it can make us look bad. And maybe that's belittling the point a little, but I think it's something we can all understand, that when Christ was here, living in a way and showing up these people who, especially the Pharisees, who thought they were very good, but showing them that in actual fact, their motives were all wrong. They were doing it from a wrong heart and doing it from a wrong point of view. That can be hurtful. And the reaction to that, and especially for these people here that Peter is writing to, that reaction often came as persecution, as abuse, and as difficulties. I will say that the fiery trials, I have heard some people say, I'm not sure how exactly true it is, but this might be a very literal fiery trial, that this was around about the time that Christians were literally being burnt for their belief. They were literally being attacked, put in jail, hurt very physically, and killed for their belief. And I say that, and I'm sure, I think that we've heard similar things before, but I just say it to remind us once more that the persecution we face is very small. And maybe that's a reflection on how very small it is and how very little we're being different. Maybe the size of their persecution here is a reflection on how much they are wanting to glorify God in their life. Maybe not. Maybe I'm taking that analogy a bit too far. But I feel like there might be a correlation between how much, and it says this in Peter, if we step out and be different and want to glorify God and live in a certain way, there will be suffering. But it then tells us to rejoice and be glad, because we're left with a promise that we can cast our cares on God. We can cast our cares on him because he cares for us. We're left, we still have this relationship, that we have this support, as well as the church that we also have. So this leads me to my last point. I'd like to talk a little bit about that support, a little bit about the church as a unit. This is the last of the 7 points. And it's probably the longest and biggest of the 7 points, because it's talking about shepherding the flock. And this is all of chapter 5, basically, in the book. And it starts by saying, "So I exhort the elders among you, shepherd the flock of God." And then a few verses later, "Likewise, you who are younger, be subject to their elders." So we see both elders and younger people have a role to play in this shepherding, in this flock behavior. And if someone said to you, "Oh, you're a sheep, you're just a sheep," that might be a little bit hurtful. It's almost a bit of an insult, because we see sheep and they are often thought of as quite a dumb animal, just kind of following the rest of the pack and, yeah, not really thinking for themselves. But I think we have to admit that looking at ourselves, and especially looking at humanity, I mean, we see a perfect example in panic buying. Someone thinks they're going to run out of toilet roll. They buy 20 of them to last them a week. And then suddenly the rest of the world thinks they're going to need to have enough toilet roll to build a castle. And we see that kind of sheep-like behavior happen very quickly and very easily, even in a first world country, even in a country that has universities and, you know, a huge percentage of the population. Almost everyone's been to school and had 12 whatever years of education. Still, people panic buy at the slightest thing. We see that kind of sheep-like behavior. And maybe it is a little bit insulting, but maybe we do need to realize that behavior and that tendency is also very much in ourselves. And leading on to why it's in this book, why Peter's mentioning it here, we see in chapter 3, he also mentions something about this. I haven't got those verses on the slides. I'll just read them out. Oh, sorry, chapter 2. Says in verse 24, talking about Jesus, "He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, For you were straying like sheep, but now have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. And there's a few references to this as you go through Peter's writing. And some of you might remember that particularly Peter was drawn aside by the Lord and had this conversation, a bit of a strange conversation with the Lord. And Peter was the one who denied the Lord three times. And the Lord went to him and said, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter said, "Well, yes, of course, you know I love you." And the response was this: "Feed my lambs." And I think the third time, "Feed my sheep." And we see it coming out in his writings here. You can kind of see years down the line that this is like been ticking over in Peter's mind. He's now putting it through. He sees this reference from Isaiah 53. He sees how we are like sheep gone astray, and that Jesus is the good shepherd, as he said in the Gospels. And he's the overseer of our souls, and we are like sheep. And you can kind of see these connections happening in his mind until it finally comes to this in chapter 5, saying, instructing the elders to be the shepherd. In the same way that Jesus is the good shepherd and the true shepherd, we, particularly the elders, are called to shepherd the flock of God. And some of you might remember, I do, remember Michael Vogelsang, who travels to quite a lot of different meetings in different places, especially in Europe, stood at the front giving a talk. I can't really remember much about the talk, but I remember him saying this. He's been to a lot of meetings. And he said this: "I've never been to a meeting where they said to me, 'Michael, here we have too many shepherds.'" And that really, really stuck in my mind, because it's just so true. I've never heard someone complain about that. I've never heard real complaint. I've heard plenty of times, or maybe not plenty of times, I've heard sometimes people say, "Oh, everyone wants to be a teacher. Oh, or everyone wants to stand at the front, or everyone wants to," you know, in Corinthians, they had the problem. Everyone had a hymn. Everyone had a spiritual song. Everyone had a prayer to say. But it doesn't seem like there's this problem, there being too many shepherds. Well, this could be for two reasons. One is that you can't have too many shepherds. And one is that, and the second one, is that not enough people are being shepherds. And I think it's a bit of both. And it's quite nice sitting here as maybe a younger one saying this to the elders, because often it's the elders talking, saying things for the younger people to do. But here's something particularly for the elders to do, but I think we can all show these characteristics, is to shepherd the flock. Sometimes, maybe this is a bit far, but sometimes what people don't need is a message from Obadiah or Haggai. Sometimes what people need is messages throughout the week, especially in lockdown. Sometimes what people need is care and support and concern. And I'm definitely not saying that this doesn't happen. I have seen in my own life, and I've seen many times with the people in the Zoom call with other Christians who have shepherded young people and who have cared. And I would thank you myself for that. And I'm sure other young people would thank you, people who have done that, for that also. But it is a exhortation. And maybe as I was saying earlier, it's a bit rebuking that there can always be more. It's something that's always lacking. And it's something that we should always aim more towards. And then it leads on to the point for the younger people that when others do come and do this, when we do have some shepherding, some concern, some herding, directing us in a particular direction, we are to be subject. We are to accept it. We are to respect elders. Young people are to be appreciative and respectful of that support that does come. So I think it's nice, especially throughout this book, how it's talking about unity. And it's talking about struggling with unity. And then it says for each different section of people, wives, husbands, servants, masters, here, elders, young people. It talks about different sections and how we all have a part to play. And the part isn't always saying the other people should be doing their part. It's working on your part And that's the verse I just quoted about from chapter 2. So I'll leave us with this, just the list of the seven things again. I'll read them out again, especially for the people who can't see the list. So the first one tells us to be holy. We're exhorted to be holy like God, not just to not do wrong things, but to be like God, to be love, and to earnestly love our brothers and sisters, earnestly love the church, and to put other people's desires in front of our own, which is a reoccurring theme. Point two is about building up, that we are built into a house, into a wonderful thing, really, an extension of God's relationship on earth. That we're built into a house, we are stones built on Christ, and that we should accept that position and go out of our way to then build up others who are also members of the church. Third one, to remember to be subject to authority, to in whichever capacity that is, people in the government or bosses or people who might instruct us. Fourth one, home life, the way we interact with the people in our home, particularly the advice was for wives and husbands to put the other person first. But I think it does extend to whole families, and we see people living in a home together, particularly at this time, might be difficult. Then finally, some slightly more general points for the whole church. Number five is being different to the world, to stick out, to show people that we're Christians, to show people the way that God wants us to live, to glorify God by our actions. And number six, that might result in persecution. And we saw these people were heavily persecuted. And we saw there was ramifications, there was consequences for living in that way. But that the way we react, and this is a very large section, which maybe I didn't touch on very much, very large section of the book, that the way we react can glorify God, that if we suffer for doing good, people will want to to condemn us. That's the word I'm looking for. People will want to condemn us, but I'll have nothing to condemn us for because we're living in a good way. People do intrinsically know the difference between right and wrong. And they'll see the good way we are acting. And although that may bring about persecution, there will also be a realization, in the same way that when Jesus was crucified, people stood there and said, this man has done nothing amiss. This man was a son of God. There'll be a realization that you are being persecuted, not for doing anything wrong, but for doing good. And then finally, the last point I ended on, that I think the book ends on, is shepherding the flock, that we are very much like sheep and very much a bit stupid and willing to follow the crowd and willing to easily be swayed. And that particularly the elders, but maybe I would extend that to everyone, have a responsibility to care for the church, to shepherd them, to instruct them, even when it's difficult, criticizing, to instruct and to push and to encourage others as they are the flock of Christ, as we are the sheep. And remember that in the end, God is the good shepherd. Jesus is the good shepherd. And he is the role model. And we can cast our cares and anxieties on him, but we have that role within the church to shepherd and to protect the flock and feed the lambs and sheep, as Peter was told. So that is the 7 points. I think that's everything I had to say. I'll just end on this verse, which is a verse taken from chapter 3. It says, comes at the end of the section that's talking about servants and masters and being subject to authority and wives and husbands and the different roles that people have to put others in front of them. And then it says, summarizes that by saying, finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing.